So I just want to put that out there. Also, the idea of having off-site parking is really assist the overall urban development of an urban space, because you don't have to have all the parking and driveways that cut into the pedestrian way. So it's especially helpful with the 20 to 40 in those smaller 5,000 square foot lots if they can park within 500 feet. And I do agree that there is an issue of teardowns. And so we need to look at making community lots. That is something that actually came up 20 years ago. And I put this in my document, testimony I gave to you. Back 20 years ago, and this is actually when Charlie Hales was Commissioner of Public Safety and Bob Stacey was the planning director for the city of Portland, there was a social contract made with the neighborhoods in Southeast Uplift and the livable city phase. This was back in 1993, and it was presented as the Growing Better document to the Planning Commission. And with that, it had recommendations in that said we need to address parking issues for residential uses, especially in centers and Main Street. So 20 years ago, this document came forward with a whole list of recommendations, and those included parking lots, garages, and garages that are shared between various businesses and uses, including possibly some city-owned facilities. And again, individually, there's not much strength, but together, you can make a smart park in these inner areas and make it urban density. We're all talking about this same compact. Back then, we had the visual preference survey. You may have heard about that. That was a big deal. And everybody was saying, okay, we will go for the urban growth boundary, and yes, we'll go with this compact form. And everybody was on board. 70% of the folks voted for this compact form. But part of that social contract was never addressing the needs of that study, which is dealing with multifamily parking, both in CS, actually all the commercial zones, as well as the R1, where you have comp plan amendments. So to this date, no parking requirements are in the commercial zones. So I really think this is a long-term issue, and we do need maybe a parking commission. And many of the things that were brought up today make a lot of sense. And it's a full issue that needs to be discussed in a broader context, not a knee-jerk. But unfortunately, since 20 years ago, something came forward, a full document with all these great ideas about urban form, but never followed up for the recommendations that the community needs, which is dealing with parking. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks.
Well, good afternoon, everyone. Hello, Mayor and Commissioners. My name is Amy Anderson, and I am a resident of Richmond neighborhood. I live about two blocks from the current project on 37th and Division. I've lived in my home now for 23 years, and about 10 years ago, I've chosen not to drive anymore. I just decided I would use public transportation and find other ways to get around Portland. I used to ride a bus 2 hours a day each way to Jansen Beach and back, Washington Square, and all over the place. So I've ridden TriMet longer than probably some people have been alive. So I know the bus system, and please do not expect anyone with children and babies and groceries to ride your TriMet bus system, because it isn't going to happen. I can barely do it now, and now I'm disabled, and it's a nightmare to get on the bus. So that's the first thing I want you to be seriously honest about. New people are not going to ride our buses, not the way they sit right now. The second thing is, if you were to visit my neighborhood, you would see that both Carruthers and Sherman have no exits on either end. They are dead end on both sides of the street. So on 37th Street and 38th Street, we have no through access out should anything happen in our neighborhood. God forbid I should need an emergency and a fire truck or an emergency truck couldn't get into my neighborhood because now I got all these cars parked on my streets. So I do want you to think of the fact that the building entrance is facing another building that also has no parking available because it's too is a small commercial building that's been there a very long time. So I find it kind of odd that you tear down a building that had over 100 parking units in it to build a building of 84 units with no parking structure in it. So I'm still trying to work that one over. The other notice I got in the mail the other day, which was a letter from the city that says over one-third of Portland's 2,500 miles of sewer pipes are more than 80 years old. Projects to replace or repair aging sewers are important for our, you know, particular areas. Well, my area is slated to be up for redevelopment in July, which means not only bus number 4 is going to be tied up for lack of service, so will bus number 75, which is the only bus that goes down 39th Street. So I do want everyone to be aware that all these projects going on at the same time impact my ability to get downtown on the bus in less than an hour. I have to offshoot an extra half an hour every day to make sure I'm downtown on time with all the construction going on from 12th Avenue all the way down to 45th. So if you have not been in that area in a very long time, I urge you to come. It's not safe. There are no crosswalks. There are no stoplights. I have to walk 10 extra blocks in either direction to get my bus now, and I'm disabled. I don't have a choice. I have to walk. And so this whole thing for me and a lot of my neighbors has been really inconvenient, but I know that you guys are going to do the job and you're going to put in parking so that we all feel safer walking down these very narrow streets. They're not very big. They're about a buggy cart wide, and so is Division. So please think about all this real seriously and consider us neighbors, the seniors who want to grow old in our homes in that neighborhood. We need to have access to emergency vehicles, especially in case of an emergency really happens. We have to make sure that we're protected as well as the new tenants. So thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Thanks for being here.
Major Hales.
You're on. You just have to wait. It takes a half a second.
Okay. Major Hales, commissioners. My name is Robert Wright. I'm a native of Portland. I've been away for some years, but have returned. I've been a resident of Portland's West End neighborhood since 2006. I appreciate the opportunity to address the Portland City Council on the important issue of minimum off-street, on-site parking for future multi-dwelling buildings. A fundamental, if not critical, consideration for city planning is the diversity of its neighborhoods. Portland is well known across the country for its planning and policies that foster diversity and livability. Investment in public and bicycle transportation and the establishment of minimum requirements for long-term bicycle parking are prime examples. Lessening the need for day-to-day travel by private vehicle in the city is the correct objective. However, this definitely does not mean that everyone will give up a car ownership altogether. Individuals and families that can afford to do so will elect to own a car when other means of transportation cannot meet their needs. Minimum required parking for private motor vehicle ownership for multi-dwelling building residents will be a determining factor in the future economic diversity of a neighborhood. The extremes, as a percentage of the total number of dwelling units, are not good planning factors. 100% will result in expensive urban dwellings financially out of reach for many. 0% will result in low availability of urban dwellings for car owners that can't afford the cost of on-site parking, meaning they will stay in the suburbs. A balance is certainly needed for a healthy, economically diverse urban neighborhood. The proposed 25% on-site parking minimum is too low and is also inconsistent with the recent survey of residents of apartment buildings with no on-site parking. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you. Thanks for coming.
Thank you.
Next four are Hiroki Tizumi, Tim Ramos, Pam Quinlan, and Tom Nielsen. And they'll be followed by Wendy Rame, John Golden, Sam Rodriguez, and Elizabeth Varga.
You. Welcome. Go ahead, Tim.
Mr. Mayor, for your record, my name is Tim Ramos. I'm a lawyer with the firm of Jordan Ramos, and I'm here today on behalf of Dennis Sackhoff and the 37th Street Apartments. Mr. Sackhoff asked me a short while ago to participate in the direct conversations that were taking place between the neighborhood and the developer over the apartment project that was the subject of litigation that you've discussed. My role was to suggest to him opportunities and ideas for bridging the gap between the two parties. To the credit of both sides, in my view, All issues but one were dealt with. They reached agreement on a large number of changes to the program and to the project, which could address the impacts of the project. They did not agree on the treatment of the top level of the building, which was asked by the neighborhood to be removed. That wasn't really economically possible, but even there, modifications were made. So I think the conversation was certainly well worth the effort. Today, I have two legal issues to bring to your attention and make sure that they are in the record. The first relates to the suggestion you have heard that you should adopt an ordinance which is immediately effective. And the issue here is notice. In the understandable haste to try to close the window, to shorten the window of opportunity for people to apply for buildings without parking, the idea might be to adopt something immediately. The risk that you run in doing that is that you may create exactly the opposite result. The fly in the ointment is ORS 215-503, which is a notice requirement which has not been complied with at this point. The risk you run is that someone raises that on appeal, invalidates, or at least puts a pause on the effectiveness of the ordinance, and therefore you would create a window of opportunity for people to make application much larger, an opportunity of many months rather than a few weeks. So for that reason, I would suggest that the prudent course is either to pause the process in order to comply with the notice requirement, or be sure that the implementation schedule that you adopt is sufficiently long that you don't draw a challenge to the ordinance itself. I've submitted a letter into the record which deals with that issue and explains it in more detail. Second, I commend to your attention the letter of Mr. Joe Willis of the Schwabe firm. The city is itself entitled to notice when it is approaching a situation which might cause litigation in certain contexts. This letter details that risk and is there for that purpose, and that's why I draw it to your attention. Thank you.
Mr. Ramis, so that we have the benefit of getting our own legal advice at an appropriate time, I have your letter that lays out the notice issue.
Yes.
And I appreciate you stated it as plainly as possible, but perhaps if you just elaborate a little bit as to what you think the deficiency was,
yes,
using the code as a guide, just so we could understand your position.
Yeah, I have taken the opportunity to share this issue earlier with the city attorney's office, yes, so that we're not blindsiding you with it. In a measure passed by the voters, a law was adopted which says that when you adopt a change to a zoning code which has the effect of changing the range of uses or limiting in some way the use of a property, those individual property owners are entitled to mailed written notice. In this case, that's not yet happened. We've reviewed the record in this case, and we've not found such a notice. So that is the issue that would be raised if someone chose to challenge this ordinance.
And just so I'm clear, you're here representing one developer.
That's correct.
So in raising this issue, you're letting us know that he may have a claim under this provision.
Yes, my real purpose is to point out the risk to the city in acting immediately. It seems to me that to the extent that you do not adopt an emergency clause or to the extent that you allow some time for implementation, you reduce the risk because in that circumstance there would be lesser risk that someone would actually appeal the ordinance.
Mr. Sackhoff has a number of people here who have testified either in person or through correspondence that purport to be representing them. So we did hear earlier Mr. Wilson say that as to Amendment 6, he supports that amendment, which would clarify an issue that Luba has raised. One option for the council is to adopt the amendment and accelerate its effective date so that it would govern any subsequent permit that he seeks. Is your view that if we were to do that, it would still be invalid, or can he waive that?
Well, it seems to me there's a solution to that, and that is that various parts of your ordinance can be implemented on a different schedule. There's no requirement that every section of the ordinance be implemented on the same schedule.
Okay, thank you.
So, I mean, the schedule, I mean, there's not going to be an emergency clause attached to anything today. So the normal course that we're expecting would be it goes to second reading next week and then becomes, if adopted, effective 30 days from there.
Yes.
Is that the type of adequate notice under Measure 37, and as long as we mail that decision to property owners?
Well, if you were to adopt, I would answer this way. If you were to adopt on that schedule, we would not object.
And furthermore, if it was the council's will to slap an emergency clause on next week so that the rules were clear to everybody and there was no period of time of where someone could get in under the old rules, and that the rules would be established for all, your view is that we might run afoul of the statute?
That's right. And the risk there is that someone challenges it, overturns the ordinance, and then instead of a window of a certain number of weeks, you would have left a window of many months.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes, please.
Hi there. I'm Pam Quinlan. I've lived in Portland for a long time. I have a lot of friends in the Richmond neighborhood, and I used to live in Hosford, Abernathy. You guys have a really important decision today, and it's not just about parking. It's also about congestion, because we know the two things go hand in hand. Like a previous speaker, I've spent a lot of time on Division Street, and I'm getting increasingly concerned about congestion, the loss of parking spaces. And what's that going to do when we have a big fire in one of those new, denser buildings? Those ladder trucks are not on bicycles. I cannot stress that enough. We do not have bike ambulances here. Livability also involves staying alive. We know that our ambulance response rates here in Portland, they're supposed to be around, the average response rate that you aim for is about 5%. Now in Portland, the ambulance response times are more towards 6, 7, 8%, which can be a matter of life and death. Part of that's the terrain, okay? It's the rain, it's the West Hills, it's hard. But I'm concerned that some of these delays are man-made, and we can stop those. I feel that Commissioner Fish's amendments right now in terms of an emergency, those to me make the most sense in terms of public safety. We cannot risk the deliberate congestion. That is one of the policies of BPS. We can't risk it on these narrow streets around Richmond. There's an emergency. It's a little different from the emergency that you see. The emergency I'm worried about are flashing lights and stroke victims and people not making it to the hospital in time. I ask you to please, I know there are a whole bunch of considerations, but to me that's a real fundamental one. And I do hope that you, everybody strongly considers Commissioner Fish's ideas. Thank you so much.
Ma'am, just in the odd chance that we've raised the blood pressure of people listening to this, I just want to clarify one thing you said. Our for response times to fires, our goal.
Oh.
The aspiration is a little over 5 minutes,
mm-hmm.
and we don't meet that all the time, but it's minutes, not percent.
Sure.
And currently, AMR ambulances do arrive on the scene within 8 minutes,
mm-hmm.
and the overwhelming majority of our 70,000 calls is city now ambulance call or medical calls, not fire. So, I just wanted to assure people that our response time to emergencies are okay, and it's not percent; it's just minutes.
I just don't want to make it worse.
No, I appreciate that, but I would have
been alarmed. We have great firefighters. We got great ambulance drivers. Let's just not give them greater challenges. I think they're challenged enough.
Thank you.
Thank you. My name is Hiroki Tsurumi, and I have recently moved to Portland from New Jersey, and I live in a condo in Portland West End neighborhood downtown. In the past, I have lived in New Jersey, Philadelphia, Ontario, Canada, Tokyo, and Kyoto, among other places. I have 2 points to make. Point one, the proposed minimum 25% on-site parking for future multi-dwelling buildings over 40 units is too low. The minimum should be much higher, say 40% to 50%, regardless of the number of units. But the exact minimum percent should be determined with the participation of the local residents in such a way that the property values of the existing neighborhood will not be disrupted. if the city of Portland is encouraging the construction of multi-dwelling buildings with no or a little on-site parking requirements, is to push Portland towards a car-free city. It is a one-sided policy that may easily disrupt the livability of the city. To maintain a car-free city, many systems and services need to be addressed. Tokyo might be seen as a prime example of a car-free city. These are some of the ways that Tokyo differs from present-day Portland. The public transportation network is extensive and reliable. Bus, train, and subway lines are never reduced or out of service. 6 million people live within a 10 to 20 minutes walk to the public transportation. Every child can get to school, and every worker can get to work on public transportation. Same-day delivery service is available for almost everything from furniture to airport luggage to groceries. Taxis are plentiful and always visible. Every neighborhood has a small shopping center with fresh food and other essentials within walking distance. In a successful car-free city like Tokyo, car ownership is a luxury, not a necessity. For Portland to become a car-free city, a more comprehensive approach is needed. And anyway, running out of time, so the parking policy is only one of the policies to make ideal car-free city. And to do so, the higher the minimum required parking on site is required.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
Yes. City Council, my name is Tom Nielsen. I live on the West End Cultural District. Having served as the mayor of Salem, I applaud you in your process of taking on a very thorny and complex issue. The current parking policy was adopted at a very different time in Portland's development. It was a time when light rail and transit corridors were first being developed. The city wanted to encourage higher density developments along the corridors and restrict the development of additional surface parking lots. The recent influx of no parking apartments projects was really not anticipated when the current policy was adopted. Until recent times, for example, projects would have been very difficult to finance without parking. So we're clearly in a transitional period as a city where people are using and depending upon transit more and automobiles less. But as the BPS recent study concluded, even the people living in the apartments with no parking, 70% of them still own cars. They do not necessarily drive to work or use the cars every day, but they still own one. As Portland continues to grow and develop its transit system, the number of people who will own a car will likely continue to decrease. But this transition will take time. The proposal to set a minimum of 25% parking places per unit is perhaps an appropriate aspirational goal, but is a huge reduction from what the current reality and the BPS own research documents today. Developers can also then reduce the number of required parking spaces if they do certain things. For example, as proposed, they can reduce one parking space for every 5 additional bicycle spaces over the minimum number. But the code requirements for bicycle storage has already been greatly increased over the last few years. In 2006, in the building that I live, the building code was that there had to be one bicycle space for every 4 dwelling units. Now it is 1.5 spaces for every dwelling unit in the central city, and 1.1 spaces outside the central city, a 4.4 to 6-fold increase. In conclusion, I recommend the council approve a minimum parking ratio closer, but lower than the current reality of 70%, and a phased plan to reduce to the minimum down to the 25% over time. A phased process would allow time for our transportation systems to continue to develop more fully, and our neighborhoods and communities time to adjust systematically to the changing patterns and lifestyles. If, however, the 25% minimum is approved, It should be set as an absolute minimum, and there should not be additional exemptions or credits allowed. Thank you.
Thanks, Tom. Thanks very much.
The next four are Wendy Rame, John Golden, Sam Rodriguez, and Elizabeth Varga. They'll be followed by Lightning, Chris Smith, Travis Phillips, and Richard Bach.
Very assertive.
Ron.
Wendy Rahm, and I live in the residential West End area of downtown. I very much appreciate your willingness to revisit the parking minimum question for new multi-unit residential buildings, and I also approve of the amendments by Commissioners Fritz and Fish, which I believe are heading in the right direction. I'm also in favor of the suggestion earlier of an exemption for conversions of historic buildings. I think that will be crucial for the downtown area. I'm here to request that the parking ratios you finally approve for new apartment and condo construction be applied universally to all of Portland, including the downtown Central City residential areas, such as the West End. By the city's own statistics, 88% of Portlanders own at least one car, even if they rarely use it. Needed most in downtown is dense residential mixed-use development with sufficient parking to allow workforce, residents, and families to store a car in their unit's building, even if they rarely use it. The downtown needs families. Do you know a mother who would be willing to be carless with small children? Would you want to live here, downtown, without a car? The downtown needs workforce families living here to keep the central core active, safe, and commercially, economically viable. None of us wants to see the city core returning to the dead zone it once was. Many busy business clients drive from outside the city to outside the central city to shop. One even came here today to testify. These shoppers are essential to support our downtown businesses. Downtown families need to drive children outside the central city to many activities which are not served by transit. Although great progress has been made, our transportation system doesn't yet support a carless world. We need to cut emissions, but this can't be done quickly at the expense of the economic health of the downtown. Trying to legislate people out of cars without an outstanding completed transit system like that of New York or Paris seems risky. Please consider a phased-in, realistic reduction of the ratio of parking places per unit to keep the downtown a place where people want to come live. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is John Golden. I'm from the Beaumont-Wilshire neighborhood, and I'm here representing the Beaumont-Wilshire Neighbors for Responsible Growth. There's been a lot of talk this afternoon about you all slowing down, going slower, studying it some more. Well, I was here in September with four of my colleagues from around the city, and we testified here. Two momentous things happened on that day. One actually happened afterwards when I watched that testimony afterwards, and it's a shot from behind. I first realized that I'm balding. And that was devastating.
You're in good company.
Good. The second momentous thing, and a little less depressing, that happened on the day is that you all listened. Now, Commissioner Novick, you weren't here, and Mayor Hales, you weren't here yet, but I knew that you were listening, and you absolutely have shown that since then. The time for us talking and for you all listening is over. It is time to act. There are amendments on the table, and it's time for them to be enacted. Because actually, now I think about it, there's a third momentous thing that happened on that day that we testified. 2 hours after our testimony completed, and with all of the media coverage that was happening, the developer in my neighborhood on Fremont filed for his permit 2 hours after. So please don't tell me that there isn't a window of opportunity that developers are looking at that are hoping that you take 30 more days to enact. There is an emergency in the neighborhoods, and it needs to be enacted now. A lot of talk also about this idea that maybe homeowners just like to park their cars in front of our houses. And I got to tell you, that's not what this is about. While parking is the issue that we talk about, what we really talk about is density and, honestly, safety. I'd invite every member of the commission here and anyone who thinks otherwise to try to take a left out of my street on 46th onto Fremont. It's impossible. And it's only going to get worse when these apartments that are coming up in my neighborhood, which we know and we've heard from the city's own study, they do have cars. Of course they have cars, 70%. So I came here today actually to argue for a lower number. 20 was a reasonable number to us. Because 20, remember, I'm an English teacher, not a math teacher, but it seems to be there to be about 40, 35 new cars. That feels reasonable. 40, again, the math thing might be closer to 50, 60 cars, and I think I'm getting the math wrong over here. But the point is that I'm thinking now that despite what people talk about Portland as being this utopian, beautiful image, and no offense to our visitor from Seattle or anyone who watches Portlandia, the reality is something far different. And the reality is that our neighborhoods are crowded, and our neighborhoods are becoming unsafe. Unsafe for our children, and unsafe for our pedestrians, and unsafe as we travel. So I guess now I'm actually thinking that Portland is really a reasonable place. And it seems to me, Commissioner Fish, that your proposal is of a tiered approach is a reasonable approach. I teach my students to have, when they wrap up a presentation, always have a conclusion. So here's mine. We're a shared city. We all live this place together. New residents, old residents, developers, we all have a stake. I think we all have a stake in going forward in a responsible way. Thank you so much.
Can I just ask you one question?
Please.
From the neighborhood point of view?
Mm-hmm.
If so you've talked about neighborhood safety,
mm-hmm.
and one of the concerns that we all have is about too many curb cuts,
yes.
in a commercial area, and we've heard from people that have mobility issues,
mm-hmm.
disabilities, and we've got children, families, mm-hmm. so that's a concern.
Absolutely.
So if we were to permit off-site parking for buildings that were below 40 units.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not an amendment currently before us,
right,
but
right.
I just wanted to get your mm-hmm. Reaction to that. If we've heard that the smaller buildings are likely to be mid-block.
Correct. Although that's not true in mine. Mine's a mid-block 50 unit.
Yeah.
Right.
So do you have an opinion as to whether we should, in the unique instance of a smaller building mm-hmm. that could be mid-block, whether we should provide the option of off-site parking to address the safety issue?
Mm-hmm. Probably so. I think that's part of the package, absolutely. I thought you were going to ask me about my hair, so I'm glad.
Let me just follow up on that.
Please.
Should there be parking on-site in the 50-unit development that you're familiar with?
Absolutely.
So that would be preferable to doing it.
Absolutely far preferable. I think that gate's already left, though.
Good afternoon, commissioners, mayor. My name is Sam Rodriguez. I'm the managing director for Mill Creek Residential Trust. We're a national developer of multifamily residential projects, and we have several projects here in Portland currently under construction, some under planning, others. We truly and wholeheartedly believe in the planning process and commune with the approach and planning of development that Portland takes. We believe that Portland's rules and regulations set by the city do result in wonderful and thoughtful built environment. We believe that although sometimes it seems like a complicated process, the results are good and we embrace it. We are also encouraged by the results of the city policies in terms of density and livability and how it has propelled Portland into becoming a 24-hour city with 20-minute neighborhoods. I am not here to oppose or support the parking amendments that you are considering today. I mean, I think I like the idea of the market setting it, but that's probably what every developer would tell you. I'm really here to express concern in respect of the recent developments in terms of a permit that was pulled and that was first issued, LUBA, then pulled, and so forth. I don't know the developer. Personally, I just read what I've read in the paper, and I've done some of my own research. It seems to me that developers like clear rules, and most importantly, like those clear rules to be applied fairly and consistently. Changing rules midstream is catastrophic for development. And I think it would actually send the wrong message as to whether the city is a city where people should and come and invest and develop. Real estate development is a very risky business. It shouldn't be made riskier by not knowing exactly what the rules are. I just want to sort of inform you a little bit about, you know, one of our projects, any one of our projects, we will spend between $1.5 million and $2 million in pre-development money before we even get a permit. So I'm more concerned about what happens in these midstream process. What happens with the projects that are in the pipeline? What happens with a developer that spend $1.5 million? And it's not our case, but it can happen to us and can happen to any other investor and developer that decides to do buildings and to develop properties in the city. What happens to that? So I would implore you to take a look at how you implement this and what happens to the projects that are in the process. I think I better hurry up here. This is I think this is a very dangerous precedent. I think the rules can be changed, but you should be careful how you change them. I would urge you to look at the long-term consequences of applying these rules to projects that are in the mainstream right now. I think the city, development actually helps construction jobs that are very much needed right now. It helps with the enhancements of the city's tax base, and it also helps fulfill the city's goals of density and sustainability. And I think it's important that we keep that in mind as a whole at a 30,000 foot level.
Thank you. Thanks very much. Hi. Welcome.
Mayor, Commissioner.
Is that on?
Yes, okay. It is. There you go.
Okay. My name is Elizabeth Varga, and I live in the Richmond neighborhood at 2335 Southeast 37th. And I'm also a part of Richmond Neighbors for Responsible Growth, a group, as many of you know, which is working to promote a balanced approach for increased development on Division, and which has banded together with other neighborhood groups to advocate for well-thought-out density, good design, and a stronger public process. I'm here first today to thank City Council for all of your work on behalf of our city. I know you too all support good, responsible, and balanced growth in our neighborhoods, and I appreciate all the efforts you've made to bring us here today. I thank you for all your time spent meeting with us, touring our neighborhoods, and listening to our concerns. And I would like to ask you for your continued advocacy and leadership today by passing these zoning amendments as proposed by Commissioner Fish and enacting them immediately. I also have the voices of over 600 community members by way of a petition urging you to do the same. The electronic petition, which was put out by Richmond Neighbors for Responsible Growth, was sent to City Council last night with over 500 signatures, along with some comments, which I hope you guys will review. And I have here the paper petitions with over 100 supporters. While we know these amendments don't address the other equally, if not more critical, issues facing our neighborhoods, density, defining the type of density we want, design, which maintains and enhances the character of our main streets and neighborhoods, and the strengthening of our public process, these amendments are a step in the right direction. And they are, at this moment, the only mechanism that will mitigate the negative impacts of these large-scale apartment buildings today. We are at a critical moment in many of our neighborhoods, a moment which requires emergency intervention now, not 37 days from now. Failure to implement these changes immediately will cause more irreparable harm and give more opportunity to those who will push through as many no parking buildings as possible without regard for the communities that they impact. I understand there's reluctance to enact this ordinance immediately because of the possible backlash from one developer whose permit was reversed, whose profits will be impacted by such a decision, but who continue to build at his own risk, fully aware of the implications of doing so. But should the city postpone these desperately needed measures that benefit the whole city out of fear? Should the city act to protect itself from one developer rather than act in the best interest of all of its citizens and the neighborhoods we all treasure? I have a recommendation for a possible escape clause. For those that would be impacted by the immediate implementation of these measures, we can give them the option to come to the table with the neighborhood association and work out a reasonable solution with a mediator in lieu of being subjected to the full force of these measures. We can compromise. Their choice. I think we can all agree we all want a strong, vibrant city with the strong, vibrant neighborhoods that reflect the values of our community. We want neighborhoods that work for all of its residents, renters, homeowners, and business owners. We want streets that are safe for everyone, pedestrians, bike riders, people who have scooters and cars. We want streets that are free from the congestion of cars driving around looking for parking.
While these amendments don't deal with the changes needed to address the broader issues of good density, design, and public process, it does deal with one of the symptoms which affects the quality of life, livability, and safety of our neighborhoods, and it can do that today with your vote. Please consider the neighborhoods that will be forever changed and negatively impacted by not adjusting the current codes immediately. We are relying on City Council to do the right thing to ensure that our neighborhoods continue to grow and thrive in a way that meets the needs of all of its residents. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you all for your testimony. Elizabeth, thank you particularly for not sending us 500 emails one by one, just sending us the petition. That's really greatly appreciated. And also for offering the option of a handwritten that is very helpful. Thank you.
Can I make one more comment? Do I have the opportunity to make one more comment? I just want to say that, you know, previously one of the attorneys had mentioned that about negotiations with one particular developer, and as far as I can tell, the negotiations were only on one side of the table, and that was on the Richmond neighborhood's side of the table. So thank you.
Thank you.
The next four are Lightning, Chris Smith, Travis Phillips, and Richard Bach, and they'll be followed by Tony Fisher, Steve Gutman, Donna Ernst, and Robert Liberty.
Good afternoon. Welcome.
Leave me out of the conversation. I'm not prepared to adopt anything on the words.
Go ahead.
My speaker on?
Okay. You are.
Yes, my name is Lightning. BPS Portland Parking Study. Results have shown that buildings with more than 40 units were better able to absorb the additional cost of small amount of on-site parking without passing on significant costs to residents. Interesting statement. Small amount of parking, no actual numbers provided. Passing on significant costs to residents, no actual numbers provided. Now, from the developer's position, more apartments built, less parking spaces built, equals higher apartment value, plain and simple. Now, if all the residents agreed to the car-sharing concept, riding transit or bicycling, that would be great. Although your study still suggests the major mode of transportation in the area surveyed appear to be cars at approximately, say, 65%. Your study was predominantly east side locations and a few old north and northeast Portland locations. My concern is a prime example of what happens when not enough on-street parking remains is Northwest Portland. Although no data was provided in your report to offer possible solutions about on-street parking congestion, using Northwest Portland as an example. Your study also suggests that on-street parking supply is still underutilized in many areas on the comps. Now, in conclusion, ultimately, the residents currently being provided reasonably affordable apartments for rent, they appear to be getting amenities that they are satisfied with. Housing is good for the city of Portland. No changes should occur pertaining to the parking issue until further more detailed data will substantiate such a change. And please, don't stop developers midway on their projects. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chris? Chris Smith, member of the Planning and Sustainability Commission. Mayor, I'm going to test your memory. One of the first times we met was 1997 or 98. I was serving on a City Club committee, and Commissioner Hales was testifying before us. I wonder if you remember the topic of that study.
Density, as I recall.
How to implement residential density. I suspect that both of us are going to spend our whole lives trying to answer that question.
Chris, there isn't a meeting that we have with the mayor where he doesn't fondly recall that exchange. it's part of the lore of this building.
So I am urging you to adopt the Planning and Sustainability Commission recommendation without amendment. I'm going to speak specifically to Amendment 3. If you want to ask me about the others, I have opinions. And then there's one other topic I want to bring up. At Amendment 3, capping the overall use of alternatives to parking. My view on this is really informed by my service as a city budget advisor. I know how scarce public resources to achieve our policy goals are. So with the alternatives, we're giving the developers the option to provide things that will help people make the choice to use cars less, to do things like provide trees that are important to our policy to improve health in the city, to build plazas as part of their property that all our citizens can benefit from. If we have a developer who wants to spend their private dollars to achieve our public policy aims, I think limiting that is very poor policy indeed. We should thank every one of them who will spend their dollars on those choices and not limit their ability to do that.
Chris, can I just ask you about that?
Sure.
Because I think sometimes we have to be concerned about sort of how the public views our action. And if we go ahead and say we're going to set minimums and ratios, and then we have an exception that swallows the rule, aren't we at risk of sending kind of a mixed message to folks? And is Commissioner Fritz's amendment would cap it at 50%, so there would be half the parking that's required if the developer made those investments. If we allowed 100%, then what we're really saying is that it's quite likely the current situation could continue. And then what have we accomplished here?
Well, what you're doing is you're letting the market decide how much of the parking to provide, which I'm going to get to in my last point. So maybe it's more productive if I do that first and we can return to that. So the last paragraph in the Planning Sustainability Commission letter asks you to direct PBOT to return to us with ideas for managing on-street parking. And my main thesis here is that really we're asking the question, do we trust the market to do the right thing to meet our policy objectives? And Alan Durning was wagging his finger at us for not trusting the market. I believe the market responds to the context it's in, and I think the market is being quite rational right now on division in the context. Until last year, there was a fair amount of available on-street parking in the Richmond neighborhood, and the market has figured out, and the first mover, Mr. Sackhoff, has figured out that he can externalize his parking demand on that available on-street space, and he's doing it. And it's a smart dollar decision. It may be a bad policy decision, but that's the context we provided. So I would suggest to you that the right way to come at this problem is to decide how we are going to manage on-street parking in what we want to become denser neighborhood centers. I live in a dense neighborhood, and I understand the pros and cons of that. But, we have made choices that our transit corridors are going to be the places where we encourage growth. I think we are lacking some of the policy tools to make that work well, and one of them is to understand how you make the transition from parking that is managed as a commons, as it is today, to parking that is either a regulated or a market good, either rationed with some kind of regulation or priced. And if the developer saw that the on-street environment was indeed priced or regulated and he did not have access to it, the developer would build the parking that his residents will demand. And right now, we don't have the incentives in place. Now, the developers following Mr. Sackhoff are not going to have that excess supply. I think they're going to be more rational. But, of course, we're here today. We don't have the benefit of 6 months or a year to see how that works. So that's why I'm happy to have the alternatives uncapped, because I believe the market will eventually correct itself. But I think it's important that we take on the question of on-street regulation head-on. Don't think that we solved it by changing the zoning. Because the lure of a free on-street parking space causes some fairly irrational behavior. We saw Mr. Shoup's book of 800 pages that talks about all the ways you get irrational behavior out of that lure of free parking. So let's not drop that part of the process and continue on with that. And if you'd like me to speak to any of the other amendments, I'm happy to answer questions about those.
I would like to have you speak to Amendment Number 1, the tiered approach for parking.
So I am concerned that there are some 30-unit buildings that may be made infeasible by starting at that threshold. Probably a little bit more concerned that with the larger buildings, we may build more parking than the market will demand. But in the sort of ordering of the amendments, I would be concerned about. I think Number 1 would be a little bit lower down. If I could address Number 2 briefly.
You were a little more charitable when we briefed you on this one.
Well, I think I was pretty clear with you that Number 3 was the one I was going to go after first.
Right.
But Number 2, the transit alignment, is an interesting public policy question. I mean, there are certainly opportunities for development along the routes that have a little bit less transit service, and yes, we are curtailing some of those. I think there are two reasons for that. One is the risk that, if we have a line that has 18-minute frequency at rush hour today, 2 years from now, TriMet cuts that because they haven't indicated those are their strategic priority. The frequent transit network is their strategic priority. We suddenly find a building that's been built that's no longer compliant, and suddenly a developer is either getting fined by BDS every day or has to find a parking lot and rent it. There's some pretty interesting consequences if the transit service is not stable on a corridor where you build these where you're compliant today but might not be tomorrow. The other is really as a prelude to the conversation about neighborhood centers that we're going to have in the comp plan. The effect of this, I think, is to funnel development towards the frequent transit corridors, which are, I think, primarily where the neighborhood centers are going to happen in the comp plan. Now, we may want to come back in the comp plan and say we want to align these parking incentives specifically to the neighborhood centers rather than to the transit network. But for now, the transit network is a proxy for where that's likely to happen in the future. So it is, I think, in some ways, a conscious choice to funnel development into particular places.
Can I follow up on your point about the market?
Mm-hmm.
And I ask you this sincerely because I have a lot of respect for how you look at these issues. So this is, I'm interested in your opinion. It doesn't not have much impact on our deliberations today. But you say let the market do the right thing on parking.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that hasn't worked as well as we would have liked in Northwest Portland. We don't have those parking structures. The market has not found a way to produce the off-street parking. But fair enough, at some point, the market conditions could change. And what we hear is the city should come in and build parking. Mm-hmm. But let's take another competing value, which is affordability.
Mm-hmm.
We know that the market is not providing affordable housing. So we intervene with tax abatements, mm-hmm. subsidies. There are even some legislators in our community who would like to lift the preemption on inclusionary zoning.
Mm-hmm.
Why is it that we have sort of a basic consensus on affordability that the market won't deliver the outcome we want, but we have such confidence in the market addressing parking?
I think because parking can succeed as a market good. Affordability doesn't. I mean, you can't. Markets don't particularly achieve social purposes necessarily. I think parking is not a social purpose. It's a, I hesitate to call it a convenience because for some people who are auto dependent because they have children they have to cart around or other reasons, it's more than just a convenience, but it is something you can make an economic choice around. There is the case of people who are very low income and are auto dependent, and we could get into an affordability argument about that as well, and I wouldn't debate you on that. But I think by and large, people are quite capable of making housing choices and deciding whether they want a housing unit without parking or with parking, mm-hmm. and they will make rational economic choices. So I believe that, you know, I live in Northwest. I understand the dynamics there, and you know, there are when I've moved into units that didn't have parking, I made the choice knowing what the consequences were. And there are a large number of factors. And, you know, it's not like we can say the lack of parking in Northwest has destroyed property values there. And there are properties where parking could have been developed by the private market, and the private market chose to build retail on those lots instead. And I would say that's a market choice. And if it were really constraining the retail environment, we'd see less retail buildings and a few more parking buildings. And yes, everybody would like government to come in and solve the problem and address their need. I'm sitting through the budget work sessions with you guys now, and you know, we know that's not the reality, right? We have to leverage the market and the private sector to achieve some of these goals.
Thank you.
Well, I guess, Chris, I don't want us to get lost in a long theoretical argument here, but
uh-huh.
I'm a little surprised to hear, I mean, you don't serve on the Planning and Sustainability Commission because you believe the market can take care of everything.
Uh-huh.
And if you opened that curtain back there, you'd see a really bad building in terms of relationship with the street that mm-hmm. led us to thinking about design requirements in the city. So there's an externality issue here,
mm-hmm.
and that's what we're
right.
working on.
So you know, we haven't talked a lot today about the Portland Plan and the Climate Action Plan, but you know, I'll remind you the Climate Action Plan and the Portland Plan, by including it, say that our goal over time is to reduce vehicle miles traveled by 70% in the city of Portland. That will involve people making choices not to use cars, and that will be a combination of us giving them better alternatives, including car share, and I could go on at length about that, and you know, owning a car being somewhat less convenient. If we keep working hard to make using a car convenient and in some cases using public resources to do it, we're working against our purposes in that plan. So I like parking to be priced. You know, I think that we have lots of ways that we subsidize parking. We hide the price of parking. The more we can do to expose the price so that the people renting a housing unit, picking an office location, have to see parking as an explicit add-on price, the faster we'll get to our goals. So I like making parking a market good because I believe it facilitates our long-term goals.
Okay. Thank you.
Chris, can I ask you one more question? I'd like your perspective on the
issue of whether developers can be allowed to meet part of a parking requirement through off-site parking. Now, Commissioner Fritz feels, and I think she's got a strong argument here, that if you allow developers to meet part of a parking requirement with off-site parking, that will lock in surface parking lots that might better be used for other purposes. On the other hand, if there's parking sitting there underused, my instinct is to have it used rather than build new parking that might be unnecessary. So what's your, how would you resolve that issue?
So we had some discussion about this at the Plan Sustainability Commission, and the even more extreme case is teardowns to create parking, right? And we don't want to see that. I think what we do want to see, and it may be that we need to find smarter language, is, you know, if there's a building going up that's going to build some parking, that maybe they build more parking in conjunction with a unit down the street that it doesn't make sense to build parking in, but needs to fill some parking demand. So, again, as we get into the neighborhood centers, I would think over time, and if we get the policy right, more and more of that would be structured parking and not surface lots. So I think what we have today in a code suggestion is a fairly blunt instrument, and that's one area we should spend a lot of time thinking about in the comp plan to figure out how to get sort of fungible placement of the parking we need to meet demand in a way that doesn't sort of screw up other policy goals. Today's code, it will not be sufficient for long-term to do that, but equally, I think we have a history of being successful in sort of moving parking demand a block or two, and we have, in downtown, we have the concept of preservation parking, so you can do the historic building rehab and not have to put parking in it, but accommodate that parking demand somewhere else. So, you know, we've successfully used that in the downtown area. Figuring out how to do it in neighborhood centers probably needs, you know, some variations on the tools.
I know that we want to get on with testimony, but I want to respond to that because there's a difference between shared parking and off-site parking. Off-site parking is incredibly broad and could end up in a lot of surface parking lots being there for the rest of eternity. And so I think we should move that shared parking discussion, which we've had in Northwest around Geldwin Field and multiple other places. We do need to have that discussion about how do you share church and synagogue and mosque parking lots, for example, during times that services are not being performed. But we don't want to have teardowns or just lots, especially on commercial streets. We don't want to have those with surface parking.
Commissioner Fritz, just to that point, we the last affordable housing development that we financed in the city was Gray's Landing. And that is a conspicuous example of shared parking where, after hours, the excess parking is used by Spaghetti Factory, which is an adjacent commercial enterprise. So that is right. Something that is already at least gets some traction.
Thank you.
Thanks, Chris. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Mayor Hale, City Commissioners. My name is Travis Phillips. Thank you for listening today and considering the complex relationship among parking, affordability, equity, and livability. It's clear that the current parking regulations have created frustrations and negative impacts for some Portland neighborhoods, exactly why we're here today. But the code amendments, as proposed by the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability, they're a flawed solution to the existing parking problems. They fail to address neighborhoods' parking issues in a holistic and equitable way, and I urge you to reject them as proposed and to return them to BPS for further refinement, perhaps with updates to the comp plan. I'm here today not only as a concerned citizen, but also as an advocate for affordable housing in Portland and as a representative of my organization, Portland Community Reinvestment Initiatives. I'm also here as a voice for the residents who depend on affordable housing for a decent, safe place to live in Portland's extremely tight rental market, and who perhaps may have found it difficult to attend a council meeting on a weekday afternoon. I realize there's rarely a perfect solution to a complex issue such as this one. Still, I believe some of the proposed code amendments' most glaring flaws must be addressed before changes are approved. To elaborate, the proposed change is in direct conflict with the goals and recommendations that Portland established in the Housing Affordability Background Report of the Portland Plan. The plan report states that the construction of housing, quote, affordable to low and moderate income, should be promoted. This could include development of more reasonably priced rental housing units, such as smaller units with no parking. The proposed code changes will create new barriers for developers striving to meet the city's priority of addressing declining housing affordability. It adds unnecessary expense to projects, increasing the cost burden for affordable housing providers and the low-income residents being served. Lower-income residents own fewer cars than residents with higher incomes, something that BPS acknowledged in its June 2012 document about these parking issues. But the code changes provide no mechanism for affordable housing projects to be developed with fewer parking spaces than mandated for other developments. Even if affordable housing providers could